Hello and welcome to the big interview brought to you by the V2 Sport Network. I'm your host, Anthony Kendrick, and over the course of this season, I will be interviewing various footballing guests, including bloggers and former players. For this episode, I'm joined by Peter Prickett, now author. We'll talk about his book, Developing Skill, A Guide to 3v3 Soccer Coaching. Quite an interesting chat, talking about why 3v3s is such an important exercise for teams. As well as that, we discuss Gareth Southgate's young squad, whether we could have included anyone else, whether Daniel Sturridge and a few others deserve to be in it, the fantastic win against Spain. And also, we look at the Nations League in general, whether people have bought into the format and whether it's of interest. If you want to follow us, you can at V2 Sport Network. You can check out my Twitter at @_Kendrick and also Peter Prickett at Peter Prickett. Also, there's a link in the description if you're interested in Peter's book. Just another quick thing to quickly mention, the V2 Sport Network's podcasts are all now going to be on Spotify. So if you want to check us out on there, just search V2 Sport Network and we will appear. I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks for listening. So hi Peter, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm really good, yeah. Enjoyed the England games, well, particularly the Spain game. Yeah, I'm good, thanks. So before we come on to the England squad and stuff, I know there's a lot to talk about there. I want to ask about your book, which has recently come out, I believe.
Yeah, it was released officially on the 3rd of October, although it had been available for pre-order for about 3 weeks before that, something like that. First book, so that's, for me, was quite something. I think a lot of people would like to write a book, but not everyone gets the opportunity to, and that was the big thing for me, was that I actually had this chance to do it. So it's like a bucket list thing.
Yeah.
And published by a publisher, not self-published, because I don't know, for me, that's not to belittle anyone who has self-published, but I think it means something different when a publisher has taken it and done it,
yeah,
rather than self-publishing.
I can understand that. It's almost like, I guess somebody, like, kind of a big name almost, is believing in you. It's somebody else believing in you and, you know, thinking your book will do well.
Yeah, that's like almost legitimizing it to an extent,
yeah.
Which it doesn't hurt to have that from time to time. Let's put it that way.
So how long did the book take you to write? How long have you spent on it?
It either took me 3 or 4 months or many years, depending on how you look at it. So it happened, or the material for the book had been around for quite a while. So it's, for me, it was taking things that I already had, merging them together into a cohesive whole. And I can't remember exactly how long ago, it was a year and a half, 2 years ago, I released the resource of 3v3 out there on social media. And it happened because I asked the question, has anyone got any good 3v3 resources? And I got silence. Yeah, and these accounts, Coaching Family, Planet Coach, Keep It On The Deck, etc., they're normally pretty good at somebody having this resource, but I got nothing. Absolutely nothing back. Aside from the great work of Horst Wang, and he's probably the 3v3 pioneer, but I had that already, and I was looking to expand upon it. So having having received that silence, I thought, okay then, I'll make it myself.
So why is 3v3 such an important way of coaching, I suppose, such an important thing to do?
Well, for me, what happened was I'm a big proponent of 1v1 situations. I believe if a young player can learn to dominate a 1v1 scenario, then we're going to straight away... we're going to create an imbalance because we are individually superior to the opposition. So that's great, we want 1v1, but if you're always doing 1v1, you're only really getting dribbling practices or maybe turning practices or shielding, that sort of thing. There's not the connectivity between an individual and his teammate or her teammate. So you go to 2v2, but for me, 2v2 is quite limited because it's generally quite flat. You're looking at it's a distance between two points, so you're just getting a straight line. Whether that line is diagonal, horizontal, or vertical, you're still just getting a straight line. And you will get certain aspects of the game, and you will get 1v1s, but you're going to be missing a lot of the game. As soon as you add the third player, a lot more starts to happen. You get width, you get depth, you create triangles, which, as most people will be aware, are absolutely key to the game in both attacking and defensive situations. But you're also getting large numbers of touches, 1v1 scenarios, and that for me was really important, was still getting as many touches as you could for the individual player while still getting as much of the game as possible. Overlaps, combination play, up, back and through, third man run, all of these things don't really come out in 2v2.
But with these, you're focusing more, it sounds more like you're focusing on the attacking sense rather than a defensive sense you're looking at.
Well, it does translate defensively as well, because defending practices, if you're 1v1, you've really only got one thing that you're worrying about, which is your distance from the player, and then you look at your body position. Some might look at it the other way around, but distance is going to be key. Then get your body shape right, and then focus. You go 2v2, and then you're only really getting the man going to the ball, and the player supporting. If again you add a third player, you increase the depth of what you can do. You can get someone pressing. You can get two players pressing and still have the cover, because you will see if you do 2v2 practice, one of the things that happens immediately, two players go and press, and they just go because there's no cover. Now, in a 3v3 situation, two players can press, one player can provide cover. Or you can play the other way around, and two can drop, and the one screen in front, and that's just flipping a triangle either way around. So even defensively, there are advantages playing with three than there are over playing with just two. Now again, some might go, well, actually there's even more advantages of playing with four. Yes, there might be, but you're taking away someone's touches, someone's time on the ball, and there's always going to be trade-offs. Within the book, I do say I'm not telling people only play 3v3, because you're only going to get a certain picture, but this picture is quite important. At some point, you do then need to then open it out and make it play bigger, have more complexity, more components, more connections, but you can get an awful lot from using 3v3. that will be more important or less important depending on the age as well.
Where's the best place for people to buy the book, should they be interested?
It is Amazon at the moment. Everything is going through Amazon so currently. Unless they want to go to my local bookshop in Pitshanger in West London, where they have one physical copy. Otherwise, order it through Amazon. That's the UK, and in America, it's hard copy and Kindle. And that depends on what people want. I will say, when I received it, I was quite surprised at how large the hard copy actually was. It does feel quite substantial, which is, I think, is quite a nice thing. Other people said, I was expecting like this little, almost notepad, sort of A5 size. So we got this big A4 chunky book. It was like, actually, yeah, that feels quite substantial.
I pictured an A5 book, to be honest with you. I just sort of assumed it was, but no, that's cool. Are you more of a Kindle guy, or do you like paper books yourself?
I like having hard copies on things. I have loads of stuff on Kindle and, e-books rather than Kindle, but they're all in. I try and put them all into my Dropbox as well. So the idea being, I can just leaf through these at any time when I'm out coaching or I'm off. But I'd still rather pick up the actual physical thing. Books, I think books have a certain feel to them. And I don't get that feel flicking my finger up and down on the screen that I do to the paper.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I think, there's arguments both ways, and there people would say about put loads of books on a Kindle or whatever, but I do get what you mean about the feel of a book.
I mean, I'm sure if I was someone who spent 30, 40 minutes on a train that I could read on every day, I might be more of a Kindle person.
Yeah.
But I don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll put a link in the description, whether you prefer Kindle or if you want to buy a physical copy, I'll put the link in the description. You can check it out in whichever format you prefer. Anyway, I want to move on from there and discuss the recent England games in the Nations League. First of all, I just want to mention the squad that Gareth Southgate picked. There were a few surprising names. Well, James Maddison, who we probably were pushing that he should be in the squad anyway, but then a couple of more surprising names, Mason Mount of Derby and Jadon Sancho of Borussia Dortmund. What are your thoughts on some of the call-ups that were made?
This is more our bread and butter, isn't it?
It is.
Bettinelli.
Oh, yeah.
Was the one. I know he'd been involved in a number of under-21 squads. In he comes. It's that third spot, isn't it, for the goalkeeper, which it could be a real merry-go-round. We know who our one and two are, even though Butland is playing the championship. I think we still know and accept that he is really the number two, and Pickford, who cemented himself. Bettinelli made an appearance. Chilwell, we're waiting for him to push through, and well-reviewed performance against Spain, I think, for Chilwell. Maddison, I think, probably should have been in the previous squad.
Yeah.
I think he'd already done enough. But he's shown quite a lot, I think, for Leicester. I know he's only just gone there, but should he move on at the end of the season, I don't think many people would be surprised.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that he would walk into the first teams of any of those top six sides. That would probably be something for him to think about. But you can certainly see him playing there. Were you thinking Sancho was the surprise, his inclusion?
Some people were surprised by it. There were some pushing for him, but there were a few I thought who were... There was a bit of a mixed reaction I saw on Twitter.
See, for me... What Sancho had been doing, how can you not pick him? I know maybe the case against him was what he's been doing off the bench. He hasn't really been starting. But nonetheless, the quality of the performances and how big, how much of a feature he's been for his team mean that he should really be in. More of a surprise for me is Danny Welbeck.
You're not a fan of Welbeck's?
I don't think he's really been featuring.
I think he's got a good England record. I think
his England goals record, yes, it is one of those where he has got a good record for his country. I suppose only Harry Kane would compare for goal scoring consistency for England, but he's not really been featuring for Arsenal. Certainly not as a forward. No. When they got Lacazette and Aubameyang.
No,
the big blue bear.
No, you're correct, but I think when you look at the lack of experience within the squad, I think a player like Welbeck is a useful addition to have, especially in attack when, you know, the likes of Kane, of Rashford, of Sterling and all our other attacking players perhaps lack a bit of experience. I think someone like him is a good player to have there for me.
There are a couple. I mean, Lingard is missing as we so there's no Lingard, there's no Ali, so yeah, they did need somebody in there. I'm still a bit surprised it was him, given it's a balance, isn't it, because it is, in a way, it's a forward looking squad.
Yeah,
with the age of the group, and then Welbeck is chucked in there. It's almost, that's where he's hedged his bets.
Yeah,
he's fallen back on a player when there's elsewhere it all looks like, well, if we started adding up caps in other areas, it's not going to add up to a great deal.
Another player who was in the squad you've not mentioned, there's a few interesting names, as you said. Chilwell, I think, did very well in the games. But Lewis Dunk finally got his call up. And also Nathaniel Chalobah of Watford. I don't think Chalobah is good enough for England. What do you think?
Step back to Lewis Dunk. He's been so consistent for, well, the 2 years in the Premier League. I think him getting his chance is well deserved. It sends out a good message. Chalobah is an interesting one because he's one of those players who's been on the England radar for a very long time. And they earmarked him quite early that he was going to be a player who England would be looking at because he possessed personal characteristics that suggested he would be a good fit for England. And it's a little bit like Jordan Henderson. He was earmarked very early on as having all the qualities that they wanted of an England player. Now, Henderson is currently playing for a fairly high-level club. Chalobah isn't at the moment. He's probably not where the England set-up hoped he would be. But they still want to keep tabs on him because he's been marked to go through the programme. I think this was a good opportunity to give him that.
Do you not?
He's still got time to develop as well. He's not particularly old.
Well, do you not think there comes a time though? I mean, he's 23 now. Do you not think there comes a time at some point? I would say pretty soon, where he needs to get performing, or he needs to stop being called up a bit, almost a bit like. You know, someone like a Jack Wilshere, where we've kind of wished him to do well for a long time, but he's just not quite done it. I suppose with Wilshere, you could make an argument about his England form, but that's sort of a different thing. But yeah, do you not think at some point we could say, you know, sorry, thanks, but no thanks?
Possibly. And that's where we go again, probably look at who's missing. So if Loftus-Cheek was available, would Chalobah be in? Probably not. So it was probably the right time to go with him and keep him there, but come the next squad, will he be in it? Don't know. It would depend on the circumstances, but this, it would not be a first choice squad, and I think Chalobah is a player who wouldn't be in a first choice squad. There's others. Was Joe Gomez, was he a surprise call up, or was he called up only because other people were missing? Some people have suggested he was, but his form for Liverpool says that he should be in there.
Well, Southgate suggested that Gomez had a decent chance of making the World Cup squad had he been fit. Obviously he wasn't, but yeah. The surprise for me, or perhaps surprise, what's Daniel Sturridge got to do to make the England squad, or is it irrelevant what he does because he's too old and doesn't fit the system?
Someone said to me, surely Salah needs to step out of the Liverpool team and Sturridge has got to play. And I said, Sturridge doesn't press. That is probably Daniel Sturridge's biggest problem at the moment, is England want to try and press, Liverpool want to try and press, and because he doesn't press, he's certainly, with Liverpool, he's a bench player because of what he can do coming off the bench. Now, as for England, when they've got, have they got a wider selection? Maybe they have. Do they want players who fit that? And if you look at the list of forwards, they are all players who will press, or certainly players who have the speed and athleticism to press, which I'm not sure Sturridge has post-injury problems. He had it briefly under Brendan Rodgers, but I think that might have been quite a lot of G-ing up from Suarez, but I don't think his body can do that anymore.
But suppose Kane picks up a big injury or something, Sturridge is surely our best option up front, whether he doesn't press as much, but surely he's our second best out and out striker.
Quite possibly. I'm not going to disagree with that. Now, that's probably an interesting source of debate a little bit. Does Sturridge press less than Harry Kane? I think Spurs fans will probably say 100%. I'm not sure that's what he does for England, though.
No, he doesn't. No, you're right. But I mean, you look at his goal record, and he's played 205 minutes this season, so just over two games, and scored four goals. I mean, you can't really.
But what about his? It's kind of the inverse to the Danny Welbeck argument, though, isn't it? Because what Sturridge's goal record like for England? It's not great. It's not great. I don't think he's got. I'm doing this off the top of my head. I don't think he's got more than half a dozen. I might be completely wrong. We'll probably find that out in moments. But Welbeck's record for Arsenal is not very good. But his record for England is, and it's the opposite. It's an inversion happening here.
No, you're right. He's scored eight goals in 26 games for England.
So. It's not sensational.
It's not, no, you're right.
It's not terrible, but it's not sensational. But if we're looking at form, Welbeck or Sturridge?
On current form, Sturridge for me.
I would not disagree with that. As I said, I'm not sure how Welbeck's in there. And if we're looking at someone who might be in there instead, Daniel Sturridge, probably that player. You know, who's next best in form? Glenn Murray? He's 35. I don't think so.
Troy Deeney, maybe.
Would Troy Deeney press?
Well, there was a bit of a thing because he was told that he wouldn't, he doesn't fit the style that Southgate wants to play. Troy Deeney just seemed happy to be sort of in contention, and that people were talking about him, and he was like, that's fair enough. But yeah.
A completely different player I want to mention. Maybe it's me being biased as a United fan, but for me, I think Chris Smalling deserved to be in the squad. I don't think he's very good on the ball, so I can understand that. But I think as an out-and-out defender, he's probably the best we've got. I'm not sure if you'll agree with me there. I think maybe I'm being... It comes across a little biased.
He is a good defender, certainly. We're in this world now, for better or worse. You don't pick goalkeepers just because they're good goalkeepers. You pick them because of what they can do with the ball at their feet as well. And we're in the same position with defenders as well. You might be a good head it, block it, kick it, but if you are poor with your distribution, you're probably not going to get in. Is he worse with his distribution than Lewis Dunk? I would admit I probably haven't seen enough of Lewis Dunk on the ball to answer that. So maybe could he have been in ahead of him? Possibly. But given the type of games that these are, the semi-friendly nature of them, is it worth giving Lewis Dunk a go ahead of someone like Smalling, who we may not be coming back to? Maybe. It might be a bit harsh, but I think that could be where this squad and Southgate are going.
I want to look at the games themselves. First game was a 0-0 against Croatia, a very strange atmosphere as the game was played behind closed doors. For me, that was the first game I've ever seen like live that's been played behind closed doors. Have you ever seen anything like that before?
I've seen a couple of Champions League games. Who had it?
Was it?
Did Fiorentina have it?
There was Lyon and Shakhtar this season, if that's...
No, I'm going back a few years, but there are a couple of clubs. I think one of the Turkish clubs had to play some games behind closed doors as well. And I remember I didn't watch for long, which is probably why I'm struggling to recall it quite so much. I remember watching for a bit, unsurprisingly, barely dead, because there's no one there. It was like it was more of an atmosphere with my team at the weekend on a Sunday. It's quite a surreal thing. What does come out of these games? I think it was a Spain game earlier in the year as well. Was the communication from the players on the pitch, and when they put together, it always happens, someone puts together a package of what they say and how they communicate and how much is positive, how much is negative. These can be quite revealing and interesting, and you wouldn't get those without these behind closed doors games. It's a shame that it takes that. I'm not saying let's have more behind closed doors games, because I just want to hear what the players are saying. No, I don't want that at all. But there is something that comes of it that can be quite eye-opening.
I read a thing saying that Jordan Henderson was by far the loudest player, which was noted by, I think it was the BBC who reported that, BBC guy who was there. I guess from that point of view, it's interesting. It's just a shame. It makes it such an awful watch for those fans, and you know, for those England fans who went there as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have brushed the game aside because of that. Because actually, this is the team that knocked England out of the World Cup. England were decent for about half an hour, but then Croatia were pretty dominant. They were a very strong side. Home advantage slightly negated by the closed doors. But England nullified them, let's put it that way, for the first half. some would just say the first half was dreadful, but they nullified them. They hit the woodwork a couple of times. They missed other chances. That's a pretty good away performance.
Mm. No, I agree with you. I think it was a good performance, and if either side were going to win the game, it was England. I think a draw was a fair result, but yeah, we were definitely the better side in that game. And yeah, I definitely agree with you that it has been overlooked to some extent because it was such a hard watch.
And equally overlooked because of what happened afterwards, or England's next performance.
Yeah. Perhaps, yeah. I guess that it makes sense to talk about that great win over Spain. With the attacking play, almost, I guess, that 3v3 book, maybe Gareth Southgate was reading that, because some of the 3v3s with Kane, Rashford and Sterling against the Spanish defence, I thought our attacking play was outstanding in the first half.
I think they might have been watching last season's videos of the Liverpool front three, the way that they were combining, because it was quite similar in the way, Liverpool did quite a lot. Firmino would pop it off and it would go out to Salah or Mane, and they would flood forward. The opening goal had definitely had shades of that. So great, superb combinations from from England on the break. And they absolutely stunned and rocked Spain. They stunned and rocked all of us as well.
Yeah, it was most unexpected, particularly with Sterling scoring a couple of goals. The first goal was an excellent finish. Something he's not scored for a long time for England before that. And I guess that's a bit of a monkey off his back, that.
Hopefully, yeah. I hope. As much as his finishing and his first touch in dangerous positions haven't been particularly good, the treatment of him has been appalling. It really has. It's not like he's been playing terribly. It's not like he hasn't been trying. What those who have defended him have said about his good runs and intelligent runs off the ball is 100% true. People were just berating him because he didn't score. And then they were also berating him because there was something about him they didn't like. So this gave them an opportunity to stick the knife in. And hopefully this performance will be a gateway to further good performances where people just will not have the opportunity to open their mouths, because I'm sure even if he unfortunately one slip or step backwards, they'll be straight back on him.
Mm.
And it's terrible, and he does not, I don't understand how anyone can deserve that, or people can even think that they deserve it, and yet it's what has happened.
Do you think that it was perhaps a bit annoyance that Sterling continued to get chances for England, overlooking different attacking players such as, say, Rashford?
How many chances did Rashford miss?
What, over the World Cup?
In the previous Spain game, I think it was.
He missed two big chances, didn't he?
Yeah. And had other situations where he didn't get it right in the manner that Sterling hadn't got it right. So the treatment again of the two, completely different. Yet, okay, Rashford did score an excellent goal, but he missed those big chances and wasn't treated in the same way. Mm-hmm. I know there's going to be a debate about who should play, and Rashford I think probably is a better finisher than Sterling. And actually, England are probably better when both are on the pitch.
Mm.
Which is where Lingard not being there may have helped England.
Mm. Do you think this system is a good system with the almost, well, sort of, it's somewhere between a 4-3-3 and a a 5-2-3, I suppose, with Eric Dyer somewhere between a centre back and a defensive midfielder almost. It's like an old school sweeper almost.
Well, I think one of the things that was said, and it was certainly said by me and amongst many other people, was the next step for England was greater tactical sophistication. Mm. And what I meant by sophistication was flexibility.
Yeah.
Playing in just one style, or one, or more specifically, one shape, rather than one style, because the style didn't change that much. Mm. Probably a bit more counter-attacking, but that's fine. That's probably what England needed next. So to be able to change between the two is going to be quite important moving forward. And if this is the different way, or the alternate for England, I don't have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Having someone like Dyer who is able to step in from the defence to the midfield and from the midfield into the defence can only be beneficial. And after all, it's exactly what Gareth Southgate himself did during what was a fairly, a relatively successful era for England. So that ability for a player to step in and out, and also for the forwards to step in and out, it's going to help because they'll be less predictable, they'll be more flexible. They should be able to manage the game better.
Mm.
And that was something that didn't happen in that, in the Croatia semi-final.
Yeah.
They were unable to affect the double overloads out wide because they were still playing with two wing-backs and they couldn't get players back in to help them.
Yeah.
If they played this system, they might at that time, or switched to this system at that time, they might have been able to cope.
Mm. And do you think that beating Spain and beating a massive side, a big side, mentally for the players will help them to believe? Because for me, I think it's a really crucial win, really.
Getting being walloped.
Of course.
This is one of the other things about it, is the context of the game. Not just for England, not just Spain's very fine home record, was 23 games, was it, without defeat? Now, someone was always going to beat them at some point. That's just what happens. But it was the fact that they destroyed Croatia, they destroyed other previous opponents. It wasn't that long ago, just before the chaos of the World Cup, they demolished Argentina 6-1.
Mm.
They've been pumping goals past people, and to an extent where losing 2-1 at home to them was viewed as, oh, that's not too bad. So going there and winning is more than not too bad. And the stats are a bit lopsided when you look back at the game, but I suspect very much for England, when they're going to come at us in this second half, let's try and soak it up, because it's the realistic thing to do. So stats can, they can go out the window at times. The context of it is that England could very easily have got demolished, but they didn't. In fact, they clearly didn't. There was a point where it looked like Spain could have been the ones that were demolished.
So there's been obviously criticism of the of all the international friendlies played, and UEFA have tried to fix that with this new Nations League. So with these two games, firstly the 0-0 in Croatia behind closed doors and the 3-2 victory over Spain, are they two very good learning experiences for this England side that perhaps have been made even better by the fact that it is a Nations League and it's a, let's say, semi-competitive game?
Yeah, I mean, England had tried themselves to sort of edge towards more meaningful friendlies with what they were calling prestige friendlies. We played a lot of friendlies in the last 4 years or so against bigger name teams to try and test them.
Mm.
And now it's kind of like UEFA went, yeah, actually, let's just formalise that process by having... it's not quite what they're going to do in America for the Premier League teams at the start of the season, because there's probably a bit more meaning to that than those competitions, but it's not too far removed from it. We are playing, England are playing bigger names, bigger tests, home and away format, which I think is quite significant as well, because that helps to provide some almost immediate, this word again, context of what's happening, because an isolated friendly doesn't necessarily mean a lot. One-off games, when you see them playing twice in relatively quick succession, you get more of an overall feel for where things are.
Yeah.
And I think that lends more to it. So there's definitely been a feel of these games mean more than, well, how long ago was it we were getting those internationals where it was a, you know, everyone off at half time, it was a whole new 11.
Yeah. Well, they're only allowed 3 substitutes.
Yeah. So everything around it feels more like a real game, not just something that's been put together for some reason. And that was the other thing. Why were these friendlies existing? What were they for? What was the point of them? And it was very hard to answer that. There is a reason they have made it, that there is a reason for these games. They are this other route into the Euros. And you look at the structure of them, of the groups, you're getting your lower ranked teams getting to play each other. And that's something that's been called for quite a while. People have talked about pre-qualifying for qualifying. Let's have San Marino and Andorra face each other to see which one gets to get walloped by the decent teams. Well, they're getting to play each other now, so they're getting something that's a bit more even, a bit more equal. And then the other teams at the other end, so it's dovetailing it together for a higher standard or a relatively level standard of competition, which is something that sort of happens in Sunday League youth football.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that they try and do. They try and match them up so we get a level of competitiveness between them rather than mismatches. And a lot of the times, international football is either without context and meaningless, as people say, or a complete mismatch.
Yeah. I think the bottom line you've got to look at for England is that we could potentially go into that final game with Croatia knowing we win the group if we win that game, and we're in the last four.
Yeah. So again, it creates as long as they do take it seriously, because we can't guarantee that, unfortunately, they might, for some reason, they might decide, well, actually, it doesn't really matter. But it still has something on it. That's what it means. The game has something on it. And it's got that additional factor to it, which means it should be extra effort, extra focus. And that's far removed from even an isolated England or England versus France one-off game. Yeah, it's great we're playing France, but what else is there to it?
I guess a negative perhaps is for someone like Harry Kane, it's going to be harder for him to match Wayne Rooney's goal scoring record because he's not got as many games against the likes of Andorra and San Marino.
Well, I'll still get those in qualifying.
Yeah, true.
On the qualifications for the next Euros, he'll still play them. And actually, how many times do they score threes and fours against these teams now? They don't seem to. Not like you could go back further to Lineker when England were playing even Turkey and winning 8-0. Malta winning 5-0 and Luther Blissett. Right, was it Luke? Not Luther Blissett. Who got five? Malcolm McDonald, I think, got five in the single in international game.
Hmm.
So it is just going to be harder. But if that's part of the beauty of football, is that goals are generally meaningful.
Yeah.
As opposed to basketball, where a single bucket is not that meaningful on its own, because it's seldom going to be the one that actually decides the game.
Yeah.
You know, watching a game of basketball, the points that are scored at the beginning of the game are not going to be the points that win the game. But a goal in football in the first minute could be the only goal of the game.
Mm.
So the scarcity of goals increases their value, so they're more meaningful. If you're winning 7-0 every week, they're less significant.
Mm.
And teams, I think, are working harder to not be beaten 7-0. We see that with the way that they set up. Whereas before, I think teams, even in internationals, were happy to come and have a go.
Mm.
We're just going to, let's just see if we can score a couple. Doesn't really matter if they pump a few in at the other end. Whereas now, they do sit in a block. They are hard to break down. All of those things, they are well coached.
Mm.
Even the minnows come and do it. We've seen it. We've seen England winning 2-0, 3-0 against countries who go back 15, 20 years. It would have been 5-6.
I just want to give a quick mention to Gibraltar, because they've won their last two games. They won their two games over this period. They beat Armenia and then Liechtenstein, both by a single goal. They're now only 3 points off Macedonia in their group.
Wasn't there a stat that Gibraltar had won as many competitive games this year as Germany?
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
I might be wrong, but I'm sure I heard that trotted out on TalkSport. Of course, there's every chance that TalkSport were wrong.
No, I think you're right, actually, because I think they won one at the World Cup, didn't they? And they won one Nations League game, so that would add up.
As I said, well done. So well done to Gibraltar, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. But it's like you said, though, it's not just the big teams that the Nations League's good for. It's also great, and it gives the chance for the likes of Gibraltar and San Marino and whoever else to improve themselves, for sure. So as a Nations League as a whole, is it something that you would say you follow? Because I know on Sky Sports and all that, they're really trying to big it up, you know, like the Champions League, where we're interested in all the European games and all that. Are you interested in, say, I don't know, I watched like Holland v Germany. I didn't watch much else, to be honest.
I watched Holland versus Germany. I watched Germany versus France.
Mm.
So it is good having these fixtures. You go, oh, yeah, that's a proper game. Yeah, I'll watch that. So I think it did take a little while, I have to admit. You know, for that first round of games, was just okay. But I think it's come to life. I think people are definitely seeing, they're no longer going, oh, I don't understand the rules, what's the point? They've sort of seen past that and gone, actually, we're getting some decent quality fixtures.
Mm.
We're certainly getting more incident and more to discuss and more to grasp than we did with the friendlies that we would have had at this time. So I think they may not have quite nailed it, but they're pretty close.
Mm-hmm. And just one final question. I had another read of all the rules and everything of the Nations League this morning in preparation for this show. But I still can't get my head around the whole process. I get bits of it, but I don't fully understand it. Do you understand it all, or?
I can lie and say yes if you want, but no. I don't fully understand it. I know that they go into a knockout phase and they will be a trophy at stake, but I'm happy to go with it, because let's see how it plays out. Let's see what happens, because it's better than zero context.
Agreed.
So England go to Germany and win, which they did. Yeah, brilliant. We've won, and now what? Well, nothing really comes of it. Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Whereas now England have gone to Spain, produced a fine performance, which isn't just noteworthy for the record books, but actually gives them an opportunity to move on to the next phase, and it's more about feeling of knockout football, which at international level you don't get many opportunities at, and the more you get, the more opportunities you get at something, hopefully the better you get at it.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think we've reached the end of the show. We've just coming up to an hour now. Thank you for coming on this episode of The Big Interview.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. And all the best with your book. And as mentioned earlier, I will put the link in the description.
Great, thank you.
All right, yeah. So thanks for listening to the show. You can follow us at V2 Sport Network. Also, you can follow myself or Peter and _Kendrick and at Peter Prickett. As mentioned, the link will be in the description. Also, check out our other podcasts. We do wrestling, F1, as well as the football, should that interest you. So, yeah, thanks for listening and good night.